This is the second session of interviewing with Milton Sussman. January 10th, 1976.
Mr. Sussman, you've always been very active politically. Could you give us a little background of how it all began?
Well, I was always interested in the political scene, and I, from time to time, commented on what I thought was pertinent to the scene, maybe about a candidate or a party or what the party stood for. I decided to take a plunge into the arena, and in 1960, when the late John Kennedy was running for office, I decided to see what I could do for the legislature here, although the decision was not mine to make. It was really made for me. I'm sitting in my office this particular day. I was then in the advertising field, and my secretary says the governor would like to speak to you, the then governor, Lawrence, the former mayor of the city of Pittsburgh. I was naturally skeptical, and I thought that it was a caper, one of my friends who might be in his cups. So I was ready to say something that is unprintable when I recognized the voice, fortunately, and it was the governor, not calling from Harrisburg, but from across the street in his old office, the mayor's. He asked me whether I would be good enough to drop over across the street to see him. Well, you don't say no to a governor. I said, I'd be over as soon as I could. When I got there, there were the governor and the then mayor, Joe Barr, and one of the judges, former judges of our Common Pleas Court, Sammy Weiss. They had been discussing me as a probable standard bearer of the regular Democratic Party to run for the legislature from my district in Squirrel Hill, which is the 23rd legislative district. I was so stunned I didn't know what to say. It was one of the rare occasions in which I was at a loss for words, but I finally recovered. I said I'd have to think it over for 24 hours and see how it sets with the family and all that sort of thing. I discussed it at home, and the more I discussed it, the more I was determined to do so, simply because my opponent, then Maurice Goldstein, who had occupied the office for four terms already, was a virtually unbeatable candidate, and this made it a challenge to me. And so I agreed to do so, and the campaign was one of the cleanest on record because I couldn't say anything derogatory about my opponent. He had a good record in the legislature, a thorough gentleman. There are a few tricks used in any campaign, or no holds barred, but it was absolutely devoid of the familiar mudslinging. There were occasions when he even said something nice about me. Well, I lost the contest by about 2,300 votes, which was the closest that any candidate had come to Mr. Goldstein in his career in office. He ran the next time as well, and he beat his then opponent by over 7,000. So I didn't feel too bad, but I was particularly grateful for the experience because no one can tell you about politics. You've got to feel them, you've got to experience them or it, you really got to taste it. And I got the taste. Whether or not I would run again is a big question. I don't think so. But that experience was a very enriching one and gave me a deeper insight into the field of politics, much of which, frankly, is distasteful. There are times when you can't call your soul your own. I can't live this way. So maybe somebody upstairs was looking over my shoulder when that somebody brought me down to defeat. I'd like to go back, by the way, to something that I did omit. Something that's very gratifying to me, which occurred before military service, before early in World War II, as you may know, when Hitler went into Poland and was responsible for the tragedies of the Warsaw Ghetto. American Jewry was tremendously... It was about 1939.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, we went to Washington and were ushered into the White House, and after sitting there counting the various corners and crevices, behold, we were ushered into the Oval Office of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I spent for 15 glorious minutes, for the first and only time that I talked to the President of the United States. It was a tremendously rewarding experience for my colleagues and me, but I don't know that we accomplished much, because Mr. Roosevelt at that time appeared to be giving us a sympathetic ear, but really was not. I don't think that he did as much for the Jews of Europe, especially those under Hitler's thumb, as his successor did, Harry Truman, long after this tragedy had come to an end. But it was one of the precious experiences of my life, I must say. Going back a bit, by the way, to refute the impression that Jews were not aware, were not sufficiently concerned with what was happening to fellow Jews under Hitler. There were many in this country who were trying to do what they could to not only curb these unforgivable obscenities, but to prevent the spread of anti-Semitism at that time. You may have heard, you two being awfully young, you may have heard about the German Bunds at that time. Since the Pittsburgh area has a large German population, the Bunds flourished in this community. One particularly, which was the head of the then National Bund leader by the name of Fritz Kuhn, K-U-H-N. Well, I was interested in doing what I could to find out about them, and so I went to the then head of the FBI Bureau here in Pittsburgh, whom I knew. He happened to be Jewish. His name was William Rose, and he was the brother of the then rabbi at Beth Shalom congregation in Squirrel Hill, whose name was Rabbi Goodman Rose. I approached Bill to see what I could do about getting more information about these points, and he said, well, there's only one way we could do it, and that is to invade their territory without being recognized. And so I was added as a de facto member of the FBI staff. And from that point on, during my various investigations of the Bunns, I was under no circumstances permitted to communicate with Bill and the FBI, which is, of course, part of their policy. I did get into several of these meetings, most of which were held on the North Side. I attended rallies. I don't know why I wasn't recognized or questioned, because I don't look particularly un-Semitic, but at least nothing untoward happened, although I did get glances every once in a while, glances of suspicion. But I was able, nevertheless, to find out just what went on, and made as much use of it as I could in reporting back to the FBI at prearranged occasions and places. I never used the telephone. I made no conversation with anyone in public. And the arrangement that we had, of course, is, I suppose, still the property of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as it operates today. But we were able to break the hold of the Bund in this area, and finally, of course, the whole organization came crashing down to pieces over the United States, because Americans have no stomach for that kind of fascistic operation.
Can you comment on any other particular political activities, or would you like to go on to your to discussing your professional life?
The only other brushes with politics that I had was through our advertising and public relations agency, in which we handled professionally political campaigns. As you are doubtless aware, candidates need an organized promotion or publicity campaign to attain any important office. And in this community, we, in the agency, professionally undertook campaigns of various sorts, irrespective of the political affiliation. We did work for Republican candidates, for Democratic candidates, and even for some independents. We may not have subscribed as individuals to what they stood for, but as long as we were being paid for our endeavors, we did as workmanlike a job as we possibly could.
Now, what was the name of your ad agency?
Friedman, Sussman, and Bain. Well, pardon me, originally it was Sussman and Adler. My partner, Bill Adler, resigned from the agency, and I agreed to buy out his interest when he became one of the owners of TV Guide. And as a result of this affiliation, he is living very comfortably today in New York City. I finally merged my agency with one of my former employees who had left me and gone into business for himself, and the agency became Friedman, Sussman, and Baime, B-A-I-M-E. This agency happened to handle the campaign of the late Robert Dugan for district attorney. It's one of the successes that we were not particularly proud of, I hasten to add. But we did our job, apparently.
And were paid well?
Yes, not by Mr. Dugan, but by Mr. Scaife of the Scaife family. You can cut this other record out here.
How long were you in the advertising business?
Almost 20 years.
I want to ask you about some other aspects of your professional life. Now, I know you told us about your law practice.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to continue from there? Or did you go into advertising simultaneously? Or?
Well, no. It all happened while I was in the military. I was not particularly intrigued with the practice of law, even though I worked for a firm here in town. It was very decent to me. Well, you just don't walk out on a profession. But along came Uncle Sam and helped solve that for me. I had virtually decided when I went into the service to decided to leave the practice of law because I wasn't enjoying it. Although my wife was in her practice in Butler County. But what to do, I didn't know. However, I had the opportunity to do a lot of thinking about it during the virtual 4 years of military service. And it was one night in the northeastern part of Germany when our outfit was caught in a small town in the foothills of one of the mountains nearby. A German 88 millimeter outfit was taking a bead on us, and we took cover wherever we could, and I landed in a barn. The barn was generously supplied by fresh manure, which was not conducive to clear-headed thinking, but I didn't have much choice. There I was, and the Germans were popping them at us outside. One of the shells struck the roof of the barn, blew it off. So I did the next best thing and dove into the pile of manure, covered myself completely with just enough room left for my nose, because I didn't know what was going to happen next, and I didn't want anybody to find me there as a sitting duck. As luck would have it, it began to rain. Pile of manure became soupy, and I began to wonder just then whether I would see the next day's daylight. It didn't look too good, and I figured, well, if this is it, so be it. But if I were spared, what would I do when I got back home? And it was then I decided not to go back to the law, but to go into public relations and advertising, which was my first love. When I came back home, after all this foolishness was over, I, by the way, was still in uniform. I had no civilian clothes. My mother and my wife, both of whom probably expected me to be shot, had given away all my clothes to some poor fellow who came to the door. And I was walking around in a uniform for a week, 10 days, because in those days, in order to get clothes, you had to have stamps. I didn't know from stamps. So when I go back to my old law office, a couple of days after I return, I'm in uniform, which was becoming pretty campy by this time. I was welcomed, of course, you should forgive me, a returning hero. Which I certainly was. And my boss greeted me enthusiastically and pointed to the desk in my own office. There it is, ready for you to return to. We wiped it off, kept it nice. And I said, by the way, I'm not returning to the practice. And he said, well, we kept it in there. What did you say? He said, doing a double take. I'm not coming back to practice at all. Well, he said, take a month or so off. You're probably shell-shocked. You're not yourself. He said, no, I'm perfectly capable of knowing which is left and which is right. And I made the big decision. Whereupon, in due course, I withdrew from active practice. Some of them were still members of the bar. And joined up with William Adler, who incidentally is a lawyer himself and didn't want to go back to the practice. And so I think we had the distinction of being the only advertising agency in town, if not in the country, that was owned and operated by two attorneys. And that started started us off in the business. I think we had one account to begin with and struggled until we built up a very decent business. And as I said, Bill left me because he had an opportunity to get in on TV. First it was called TV Digest and then became TV Guide when Annenberg of Philadelphia took it over, bought out TV Digest to make a TV Guide. And when Bill later sold out his interest in TV Guide and retired in New York, as I said a moment ago, he retired a very wealthy gentleman, and I'm very pleased for his sake. I went on in the business, of course, having bought out his interest, and then, as I said, joined up with one of my former employees who was doing very well himself, and we combined our agencies. And when I left it to enter academic life, university life, we had a staff of about 12, 15.
When did you enter academic life?
In 1964. My reason for leaving the advertising field, which I loved and still do, is that it became too much of a rat race. And I was afraid I might end up with a familiar advertising agency ulcer. And when this opportunity came my way to become assistant director of the Department of Continuing Education at Duquesne University, I decided to take the jump. And when I notified my two partners that I had decided to go to the university, they asked me whether they could come too. At any rate, they would like to have gone into the more placid life at the university, but of course there was no room for them. And there I remained until 1974, when I was mandatorily retired by the university from the administrative position. Oh, by the way, and during those years I had become director of the department. When my predecessor retired, I moved into his post and held it for the final 4 years of my tenure at Duquesne. It didn't affect my teaching at Duquesne, which I'm still doing, and conducting management training programs, but the administrative end.
All right, now what do you teach now?
Included. I'm teaching courses in public relations and some aspects of the law.
Mm-hmm. Not just at Duquesne either.
Not only at Duquesne, but also at Robert Morris College, which offered me the opportunity to teach when I left the administrative position at Duquesne University.
Do you still occasionally teach courses in composition?
I haven't recently, no. I haven't since I...
Flunked Spirit.
Since what?
Since you flunked Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't taught those courses, that's right, since I left the University of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which law courses do you teach?
I taught a course in agency corporations and something called wage and salary administration. Simply because those were the courses that were open at the time, that were available to me.
So do you at this point feel that you have really done what you've always wanted to do and feel very fulfilled professionally?
Since I left the law, I've had a lot of fun. As a matter of fact, in the almost 20 years I was in the PR agency and advertising field, I was most happy. I was content that I was doing what I wanted to do because the agency field offers ongoing opportunities to use one's imagination, resourcefulness, ingenuity. And if you don't have that, you don't stay in it. It's not humdrum. Every day is different. Every client presents different challenges, and no 2 days are alike, even though they may blend into one another. I mean, it's exciting, for example, trying to do someone else's thinking for him. The client says, I am trying to invade a new market. What can I do to open up this market to my product or my service? This places the issue squarely on my doorstep, and I've got to do something about it. I don't always strike oil. Many of the ideas, many of the thoughts, many of the plans backfire, and you try something else. But you are, for the most part, on your own resources. Every once in a while, you might look at somebody else's idea, and if it's good, you adopt it, maybe dress it up. There's something to be said for the old saw that there's nothing new under the sun. Maybe that's true, but even if it isn't new in and of itself, you can give it a new appearance.
I think you've covered most of it, but in retrospect, are there any highlights of real successes or failures?
There's one account that we took over called Allen Rugg Company. It still functions under other ownership here in the city of Pittsburgh. But when we took the account over, the owner said, I would like to have some kind of catchy slogan that will prompt people to think of us immediately when they hear it. You're familiar with slogans, these catchier phrases or sentences. I was pondering this. There's no time limit on how long it takes to come up with a thought or an idea. And it occurred to me one day, as I was sitting in an unmentionable, that it had been years since I had seen anyone beat a rug in the bank with a rug beater. I hadn't seen a rug being beaten in years and years. And so I thought, maybe we should say, don't beat that rug, and let it go at that. Meaning, don't beat a rug today by tramping it in or scrubbing it in the house. Send it to Allen Rug Cleaning. And I figured, my client will think I'm a nut, but let's try it. So in the next conference on copy that we had, I said, I think I have something for you by way of a slogan. What's that? Don't beat that rug. He said, what? Don't beat that rug? And I said, yes. It's so idiotic that maybe it'll catch on. It'll have people say, whoever beats Ruggs, I don't beat Ruggs. I send them, well, and send them to Alan Rugg. And so we had a TV and radio campaign, newspaper campaign, on Don't Beat That Rug, and it became such a household word that we were getting mail addressed thus, Don't Beat That Rug, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they were all delivered to the destination.
Alan Rugg Company was then a cleaning.
Rug cleaning.
Yeah.
Oh, it also sold ruggings, but it's big business with it. Well, out in Highland Avenue, you have Alan Rugg now. It's still operating,
yeah,
but not
I bought
under
rugs there.
How's that?
I bought rugs.
Well, that's the company. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not it uses, I haven't seen it use the slogan because I think.